So there's a lot of details. That's what the handout's for, to kind of help you recall that. What I hope more than anything, though, there is a storyline that's shaping all together. Yes. Yes, there is a storyline that's shaping all, kind of overarching this whole thing. And the storyline is fairly basic to pick up, so to speak. You know, there's originals. They go out by many different copies and people making copies. And what we have are loads of different copies from lots of places and times and so on. And so there you go. That's the we have loads of copies. Someone asked me this question. It's actually a good one. Like, how does the text of the Hebrew Bible compare to, say, the ancient like Babylonian, you know, creation stories or something like that, or from Israel's neighbors? And so it's a really good question. So in the 1920s, up near on the coast, up in Lebanon, there was discovered an ancient city of Israel's like Canaanite neighbors. It was called Rosh Shamra, was the name of the city. And all these texts found in an ancient temple that's precisely the same time Solomon was building the temple. And it's all of these mythological stories about the gods of Canaan, same gods that are mentioned in the Hebrew Bible and so on. And there's precisely one copy of all of these stories. And they're all made on like clay rocks and so on. So like, well, we have one copy. We have one copy of all of those stories. So how many copies or manuscripts do we have of the Hebrew Bible, for example? We have thousands. We have thousands of copies. So that's the difference. The Bible exerted such a force on Jewish culture in particular, it became a culture of such intense learning and book learning, and the Bible was the text. I mean, you have kiddos memorizing whole sections of the Bible from a very, very young age in Hebrew, and of course, because that's the language that they spoke. And so this is, there you go. So again, we have so much of the Bible, more than any ancient text from any other culture, from any ancient world. And so, and that's precisely what we would expect, right? If these people truly believe that what these are what the Apostle Paul called the oracles of God, that this is a divine act of communication to his people, like, duh, it's going to create a culture of a people group that's obsessed with preserving and caring for these texts. So we're going to see something kind of similar with the story of the New Testament here. You guys ready for action? Okay, let's dive in. So the New Testament, you'll remember our timeline here. So we had the Old Testament, over 1,000 years in the making. The New Testament is kind of a different story. It's roughly maybe the earliest. This would be interesting. So if you were to think of the New Testament, if you know kind of its contents, what would you say are the first or earliest books in the New Testament? Well, you'd say like, oh, the Gospels, because they're the stories about Jesus, and that's how the whole thing started. Well, the events in the Gospels are at the start of the whole thing. But in terms of the date of the composition of the Gospels, they are not the earliest texts. Actually, the earliest Christian texts that we have are two letters of Paul, the first and second letter to the Thessalonians. And then there is a large segment that thinks that the book of James also comes from that earliest period of Jewish Christians living in Jerusalem. So those are actually the earliest letters, likely in the mid to late 40s. So Jesus, he's on the scene around 30, and he does his lightning tour of Galilee, like about 2.5-ish years. I mean, Jesus left his mark on the world history, in about 2.5 years. That's so insane to think about, you know what I mean? Like maybe, you know, we think like a lifetime career and we remember Henry Ford and the Wright brothers or something. And like Jesus, 2.5 years wandering around teaching, doing miracles. That's insane, right? But that was kind of the cradle of early Christianity, was those first years of the 30s. And then the thing just explodes. And so the New Testament, all the books in the New Testament are generated just out of about 50 years of events. And the New Testament really breaks conveniently into three big parts. You have the basic foundation narrative in what are called the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the foundation narrative of the church in the book of Acts. Then you have the collection of letters. It's illegal, it's a federal offense to read other people's other people's mail here, mail here in America. But we do it all the time when we open the New Testament. We're reading someone else's mail. We're reading Paul's mail or James's mail to other early Jesus communities. And then the New Testament ends with a very unique book, nothing like it in the New Testament, written in Jewish apocalyptic style, which was a very common form of writing in first century Jewish Christian culture, not so much these days. So there you go. So we're going to take things in turn here and kind of trace the collection and passing on of each of the different parts of the New Testament. Ready? Okay. So the narrative books. These are not the first books in terms of their date, which actually has caused a lot of controversy about them, especially in popular culture. So here's a basic timeline, and here's why I have this picture here. About 3 years ago, there was a team of British archaeologists of kind of Israel and Palestine and so on. And so essentially what they did is they got together and did visual scans of every skull that has been dug up precisely from the time period in Palestine, Israel, around Jesus' time. And then they created a computer-generated composite portrait of an average Jewish 30-year-old male skull from all of those. And so this is what was generated. So I don't know what that does to your mental image, you know, but that's the picture that they generated from, they had like about 30 or so different skulls that they used to make the composite. So here we go. Let's kind of think of a timeline like this. So we have the events of Jesus. We have his birth, his childhood, and of which we know very, very little, just the little bits that are in Matthew and Luke. And then all of a sudden, he appears onto the scene, which is where the bulk of the gospel material is, and he's like a man. You know, he's in his early 30s, best we know. And so he, in 2.5 years, you know, his teaching ministry, his healing ministry, he goes to Jerusalem, confrontation with the leaders, he's executed by the Romans, and then the empty tomb, and he's seen alive in a physical body that's different than his normal, than someone's normal physical body. He's seen by hundreds of people afterwards. And out of that comes this explosion of the Jesus movement. The book of Acts covers most of this time period here. But the actual composition of the Gospels, the four that we have them, don't appear, they're not written down and collected until this about 25-year period from 70 to 90 of the four Gospels as we know them. So Mark, for a number of different reasons, is almost certainly the first, the earliest of the four Gospels. There's lots of debate, but it's somewhere in the early 70s, most likely right after the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. And then sometime after that were written Luke and Matthew, and John, for a number of different reasons, is likely the last of the four. But all, so here's in terms of most ancient history, for example, we have a Jewish historian that left a large library behind. His name's Josephus, and he's writing about events in his lifetime and a few hundred years before. But that's actually quite rare for ancient history. For the most part, if you go to whatever the classics department here at PSU, is there a classics department? Greek classics department? I have no idea. I should know this. I don't know. I'm going to find out. But so they're reading Homer's Odyssey, right? Or they're reading kind of the great Greek histories and so on, or Latin histories. And most often the case is that the author of the book that we have is collecting material that predates the author, but there's like hundreds of years of a gap. In the case of the Gospels, we have about a 40 to 50 year gap between the events and then the four Gospels as we have them. Now, in most cases, comparatively, that's not very long. You still have eyewitnesses alive who saw the original events, who are still alive here. But all the same, especially in the popular media, this time gap has been hugely exaggerated. And so you watch stuff on the History Channel, don't ever watch anything about the Bible on the History Channel. Let me just say that right now. It's I don't know how they do it. It's always wrong. I don't know what to say. It's always wrong, with maybe 5 minutes that are actually right. And they never, ever, ever get people who represent the majority scholarly view. They get the weirdos who are on the fringe and no one even reads their books, and that's the expert on early Christianity or something. And it's really disappointing. I don't know who their CEO is, but they're not doing their job. It's like this revisionist history channel. It's really what it is. Anyway, so it's this gap right here of 40 to 50 years. It's not that long, but all the same, you know, that's 40 to 50 years, right, of this timeline between the first account of Jesus and the events that happened. And so you go, well, you know, is this like playing telephone? Like I write down a short story and then hand it to Andy in the front row, you know, and then copy of a copy, you know, or do the whisper. Ever play the whisper game in a circle, you know? And it's like always changes and so on. You're like, oh, there's no way we could know after 50 years or so on. So that's just wrong analogy from the start, right? Don't use that. Don't use that analogy. So here's essentially, this is the metaphor that I found very helpful over the years. This is a picture of a quilt that Jessica and I have. Her grandmother made this quilt. And her grandmother made it somewhere in the early 70s and then kind of passed it on to the grandkids. But this quilt right here, actually the pieces of the quilt, the individual pieces, I've just separated out the yellow ones here, her grandma actually had been holding on to the materials of this quilt from her grandmother. Does that make sense? So in other words, the actual materials in the quilt long, long predate the making of the quilt, which was somewhere in the early 70s. Does that make sense? So it's a collection of older material. This is when the Gospel of Mark was composed. The date of the Gospel of Mark doesn't tell you anything about the date of the materials in the Gospel of Mark. Does that make sense? So the real question is, well, what happened here? So we have the events of Jesus, we have the making of these quilts, but where did these pieces come from? What happened to the pieces in this time period right here? So why don't you turn to the Gospel of Luke with me, chapter 1. And the Gospel of Luke chapter 1 is utterly unique in the New Testament. This is one case where we have a little note from the author saying, "Dear reader, here's what I'm doing, here's why I'm doing it, and here's how I did it. What, why, and how." Mm-hmm. That's what he says. Luke chapter 1, verse 1. I wait for the pages to stop turning. He says, "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word." Okay, let's just stop right here. There's a world of important information right here. So, is Luke the first person to put his hand to drawing up an account of the story of Jesus? Answer, no. No, he's not. He's not. So, we know, first of all, one of the accounts that predates Luke, and that's the Gospel of Mark. How do you know that? Because Luke has taken up the Gospel of Mark almost in its entirety in the Gospel of Luke. If you ever read Mark and then read Luke, you'd be like, "I read half of this already." And that's it. You did just read half of it already. Because Luke used Mark as one of his main sources. And that's because the Gospel of Mark, although it was authored and connected to a guy named John Mark, in tradition of the early fathers, John Mark was the apprentice and kind of like travel companion of the Apostle Peter. So actually, what we call the Gospel of Mark is the gospel material as it's been derived from Peter, and Mark was the one to collect it. And so Luke has taken up his account, and there's other material that we'll talk about in a second. So where did Luke get this material? He says it's been handed down to us. And the word he uses right here, it's a technical term that refers to activity that was done in oral cultures. Now, this is almost impossible for us to get a handle on because we don't live in an oral culture. Like, we're lazy. We don't even read books anymore, you know what I'm saying? So we just, like, type in text grammar to each other, you know? Like, we are a very degenerate literary culture or something. So texts were very expensive to produce. They weren't uncommon, but they were expensive. And so maybe like a group, an early church community, a house church, would have a collection of scriptures or so on that that they have. It's probably uncommon that average, you know, folks would have their own version of different New Testament books in their own house. It was likely a group possession of a church community. And so what these cultures often do is they're oral storytelling cultures. And Judaism is still a culture like this, of just intense memorization. You can go to Barnes & Noble's and get books on how to improve your memory. You can do it in like a couple months. And all of a sudden, you're like memorizing vast, vast amounts of information. Like the human brain, we just use 5% of this thing. You know what I'm saying? So we're capable of vast, vast amounts of information up here. And cultures where writing is not the primary mode of communication, or it's oral and written, commitment of a teacher's sayings to memory and so on, that's just par for course. And particularly, who is it that's passing down these traditions, the stories and teachings of Jesus? What does he call them right here in verse 2? He calls them eyewitnesses, people who saw these events, and then also servants of the word. So this is a lot like the scribe of the book of Baruch. These were appointed individuals in the earliest Jesus communities who were eyewitnesses or connected eyewitnesses. Their job is to memorize huge blocks of the teachings of Jesus and of the stories about Jesus. And you can see this, especially when you have parallel accounts of stories in the Gospels, but they differ just a little bit by wording and so on. There's lots of different background to it, but essentially this was if your foundation story as a community is around a period of one person and events surrounding that person, and that's like, I've given my whole life to this thing, and the eyewitnesses are still like around and floating around, like this is not like playing telephone with your friends, you know what I'm saying? This is like the eyewitnesses are around, and we know where to go. Paul appeals to eyewitnesses. Paul in 1 Corinthians, he's writing to some Christians who are almost 1,000 miles away from Jerusalem, about 20 years after the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus, and he's like, dude, like hundreds of people saw him alive. Go talk to them if you want to get on a boat. Like they're still totally around. Some have died, but loads are still alive. The eyewitnesses are all around as this material is being collected. And so servants, this was how the making of the quilt pieces were kept. And so Luke says, with this in mind, since I myself, he's gone back, I've carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus. Who's Theophilus? So we don't know. He's only mentioned right here. And the book of Acts, which is part 2 of his work. So whether Theophilus was maybe one of the leaders of a church community, maybe he was a wealthy Christian who sponsored Luke's study break while he researched the Gospel of Luke. I think that's most likely, and I need to find myself somebody like that. Right? And so he's dedicating it to Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things that that you have been taught. So he's totally talking about how he made the book. He didn't invent any of this. He went to eyewitnesses and servants of the word and got the traditions preserved by these eyewitnesses. And so what Luke has done, he's a quilt maker. He didn't make the material in the quilt. He's composing and arranging a quilt. And so here's essentially the picture that that we get then of the making of the Gospels. We know that Mark was composed first because Matthew and Luke have both taken up Mark into their story. They've both used Mark as a source. But then both Matthew and Luke have also drawn on other material that's not in the Gospel of Mark. And what's even more interesting is there's a whole body of material of Jesus' teachings that overlap in Matthew and Luke, but that are not in Mark. So Matthew and Luke had at least Mark and some other common source, and then some unique material of their own. That common source is often called Q, which is just the Greek word for source, kele, which just means source. They had a common source. And so that's essentially what happened here. John is unique. Have you ever read like Matthew or something, and then you read John, and you go, whoa, that's really different. So John was likely located in and around Jerusalem area, and he he drew on a set of quilt pieces that's different, essentially, than what the other gospel authors drew on. He consulted different eyewitnesses and so on. And so that's why there's a whole bunch of unique teachings and stories in John that aren't in the others. But this is essentially how the process went down. And the eyewitnesses are just beginning to pass from the scene as these are being composed, and almost certainly that's part of why. If the eyewitnesses are all around, you don't need to write a book, you can just go talk to them. But the moment they're aging and the eyewitnesses begin to pass away, there's a need to write down as a remembrance and a witness for the future about the event. So that's essentially how the Gospels went down. There are a million and one conspiracy theories. Seriously, don't watch anything on the History Channel about the Gospels specifically, right? So we'll talk about the other Gospels that didn't get included in the New Testament. We'll talk about that in the next session. But really, I mean, this is good. These are some of the closest sources to the original events that we have of any ancient event known from ancient history. The Gospels are, there's some of the closest historical documents to the events they talk about than anything we have in the ancient world. And that's not even looking at them as a religious document. That's just using the Gospels as material for history. So there's a lot more that could be said about this, but that's essentially what we've got going on with Gospels. For the letters of the New Testament, we have a unique and different kind of story. Go to Paul's letter to the Romans with me. And actually go to Romans chapter 1 with me. This one's great. Romans chapter 1. So we're reading someone else's mail. And whose mail are we reading? From whom? Look at verse 1. Paul, that's the first word in Romans, Paul, servant of Christ Jesus, goes on to describe the gospel that he is proclaiming, and go down to verse 7, who's he writing to? Verse 7, to all who are in Rome. Who's this letter by? Paul. Who's it to? The Christians living in Rome. Go to the last chapter of the book, Romans 16. Romans 16 contains a list of people that Paul is saying hi to in the church. You know, he kind of finishes the letter and he's like, say hi to these people, say hi to them, say hi to them, and so on. Go down to verse 21. Paul says, Timothy, my coworker, he says hi. Hey, everybody. Hey, everybody. Also, so does Lucius and Jason and Sosipater, my fellow Jews. I, Tertius, who wrote this letter, greet you in the Lord. Gaius, whose hospitality I and the whole church here enjoy, sends you his greetings. Erastus, so on. Did you guys catch that? Did you catch it? It's a little speed bump right there. So who wrote Romans? So Tertius. Who's this guy? So we don't know. This is the only time he's ever mentioned. So what you have, this is very similar to like Jeremiah and Baruch that we saw here. So Paul, whether he dictated verbally and Tertius is sitting there writing down, whether Paul, you know, we have some clues from other ancient texts about how books were put together. Did Paul write a collection of theological essays and Tertius arranged them? We don't know. We don't know. What we do know is that Tertius is the author of the letter in terms of the scribe who wrote it down and is responsible for the making of the manuscript that went out to the Senate of Rome. Is that interesting? Go to 1 Peter with me. This is another interesting one. 1 Peter chapter 5. You'll see the verse reference up there. 1 Peter 5. These little letters, they're so hard to find, aren't they, in the New Testament? 1 Peter chapter 5. So if you look again at the beginning of 1 Peter, it says, you know, Peter, an apostle of Jesus to the churches in these different areas here. And you go, oh, this is a letter that Peter wrote. If you look at chapter 5, verse 12, again, he's ending the letter, and he says, in the NIV it says, with the help of Silas, whom I regard as a faithful brother, I have written to you briefly, encouraging you, testifying you, this is the true grace of God, stand fast in it. Some of your any other translations of verse 12 there about Silas? You have Silvanus. Yeah, there's a little manuscript variant we'll talk about in a minute about the spelling of this guy's name. But is it with the help of? Does everybody have with the help of? Through or by is what Paul literally says in Greek. By Silvanus, or through Silvanus, I have written to you this letter. Now, this explains a puzzle that's often come up with 1 Peter. 1 Peter is beautiful, classic, literary Greek. It's pristine, classical Greek. And so the question is how did, like, a semi-educated, Jewish, Aramaic-speaking fisherman, like, compose a beautiful letter in classic, beautiful, classic literary Greek? Well, that's because he didn't write the letter. So who wrote the letter? Silvanus wrote the letter through Silvanus. So who knows what that partnership looked like? So is Peter talking about his ideas, and then Silvanus is like, oh, I should say it like this. Beautiful. Go with that. Run with it. So we don't know. We don't know the process. But again, so what we're getting at is that what it means for the scriptures to be inspired is, again, not like somebody's taken over and, oh, don't like this. It's actually a beautiful friendship is what 1 Peter emerges out of. A friendship where you have someone, an eyewitness of Jesus, who is one of the most important figures in the early Jesus movement, and then you have this friend and coworker, Silas or Silvanus, and it's through them we get this beautiful, beautiful letter of First Peter. So even just in the making of the books, the processes are often fairly complex, even though we just read it and we go, oh, Peter wrote a letter. No, there's more to it than that. And so likely that's what's happening with most of these letters. We get a little interesting comment that Paul writes at the conclusion of one of his letters to the Colossians. He says this. At the end of Colossians, he says, after this letter has been read to you in Colossae, see that it is also read in the church of the Laodiceans. And also that you, in turn, read the letter that I wrote to Laodicea. So he's saying, first of all, make a copy of what I wrote you and make sure that they go read it down the ways. Laodicea was not super far. It was within a couple days' journey. But then also read the letter to Laodicea. Where did that letter go? You know what I'm saying? No, it's just lost to history. We'll talk about that in the next session. Like, if it was discovered in the sands of Egypt today, should it be a part of the Bible? So that's interesting to think about. But so what we get here is a clue of how literature spread in the early churches. The Roman road system was great. It was like our interstate system. It's really efficient. And people could get from all the major cities. Early Christianity spread was an urban movement among all the major Roman cities, along all the interstates, basically, or along all the highways. And so literature could spread very rapidly. And so just within, 20 years, you have people reading Paul's letters down in Egypt, even though he was writing them to audiences like up in modern Turkey. And they're just totally spreading because they spread and spread and spread. So it's like a YouTube video going viral or something like that. So it would be like a modern analogy to that. Make sure you see to it. And so they spread. This thing's just spread. Okay, so here's our original writing of the text here. Okay, we're gonna take our jump here. Here we are, 2013, and we've got a big gap between us, your English Bible sitting that you go get at Barnes & Noble's, and the composition of these letters and stories here in the first century. How do we close this gap? So the gap, we're gonna approach it kind of from this way. We approach Hebrew Bible from our time backwards, we're going to trace this story forwards. So there's a phenomenon I already talked about. Early Christianity is primarily an urban movement, and in urban settings, because there's high density of population and so on, people can specialize in different professions. And so there were a number of cities in the early Jesus movement that became prominent centers of schools, of learning, of the production of manuscripts, and so on. As these texts gained popularity and importance in the early Jesus movement, there became centers, they're called copy centers, where biblical manuscripts were copied and copied and copied and then sent back out, and copied and copied and sent back out. So there are a handful of cities, Rome being one, up here at the coast. There were a number of really prominent churches, the most prominent church in Asia Minor. We know it as the Church of Ephesus, right? There's a few letters written to Ephesus, letter to the Ephesians, but also the letters to Timothy Timothy was a pastor in Ephesus. Syria, there is a city named Antioch. If you read the book of Acts, Antioch was the main urban center from which the first missionary movement of Christianity exploded from. And then also Alexandria, Egypt, which already had an ancient library there because they copied the Septuagint there and so on. So these four regions became the kind of the hot spots for the production and copying of biblical manuscripts. Okay, so here's what happens, is that you can look at manuscripts discovered in any of these places from around this time period, and you have an emerging collection. You've got Paul's letters all over the ancient world, like within just a few years. They're just everywhere. The Gospel of Matthew, Mark, is just everywhere within just a decade. And so this is really good news for us as historians of the biblical text for a number of different reasons, because what you have is the same text being copied by different scribes in really different regions of the ancient world. So what conspiracy theory is immediately demolished, right? Of the little room of old men with white beards, you know what I mean? Just like concocting all of this to deceive the masses. It's just not going to happen. It's an impossibility. So you have Matthew, you have versions of Matthew being copied in four different places in the ancient world, Paul's letters. Okay, so here's the interesting story. And right at the beginning of 300, right before Emperor Constantine, there's a Roman emperor who began the last and almost complete systematic persecution of early Christianity. He wanted to unify the empire. His name was Diocletian. He wanted to unify the empire. He thought Christianity was a dangerous threat because they confessed Jesus as Lord, not the Roman emperor. And he thought it was dangerous. And so systematically, he went to these urban centers and began killing Christians, destroying churches, and burning manuscripts and so on. And so, I'm totally getting ahead of myself. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's stop. Can we stop? Back up. We'll come back to Diocletian because he is a heinous figure. But so let's just stop on the conspiracy theory thing here. So what this means is we have manuscripts from multiple locations. And so what this allows you to do is if there are any errors, mistakes, additions that creep in one place, you're going to be able to spot them like very easily, right? Because you're going to have a whole bunch of collection of manuscripts from other locations that may or may not have that material. So let me look at an example with me. Go to 1 John with me. This is a pretty famous example. 1 John chapter 5. And we're just going to start reading at verse 6 here. 1 John chapter 5, verse 6. He says, this is the one, verse 5, get context. Who is it that overcomes the world? The one who believes that Jesus is the Son of God. This is the one, Jesus, is the one who came by water and blood, Jesus Christ. He didn't come by water only, but by water and blood. And it is the Spirit who testifies, because the Spirit is truth. And there are three that testify, the Spirit, the water, and the blood. And these three are in agreement. And it's very clear what he's talking about here. Right? So what? This is a bizarre passage. I've always thought this is a bizarre passage. So whatever's happening here, the question is what does water and blood refer to? Some people think it's Jesus' baptism and then his crucifixion being the key elements of kind of summarizing the Jesus story. But do any of y'all have a footnote somewhere in verse like 7 or 8? Do you have a footnote somewhere in there? Verse, right at the beginning of verse 8? Nods of affirmation? Yes, okay. If you go down to that footnote, here's what they tell you, is that there are a number of manuscripts called late manuscripts of the Vulgate, and the Vulgate was a Latin translation of the New Testament produced around the region of Rome. And a number of manuscripts from this center have an extra line right here. So let's go back and read the passage and then insert this extra material that's in the manuscripts from the area of Rome. So back to verse 6. This is the one who came by water and blood, Jesus Christ. He didn't come by water only, but by water and blood. Now, it is the Spirit who testifies, because the Spirit is the truth. And there are three that testify. Jump down to the footnote. Three that testify in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Spirit. And these three are one. And there are three that testify in earth. Go back up. The Spirit, the water, and the blood, and these three are in agreement. Do you see what just happened? So it's a very dense, puzzling passage, and a later scribe at some point said, oh, I think this is talking about the Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. And so that line was totally introduced into a copy of this section here. So you might say, dude, that's screwed up. That guy shouldn't have done that. And that's right. He shouldn't have done that. What's great is that we have many, many versions of 1 John from other parts of the world and other time periods that don't have that. So we can say, slap on the hand of that scribe, like, let's get that thing out of there, you know. And so that's precisely what they've done here. Does that make sense? So this kind of thing totally happens. So once again, it's not that we don't have, we actually have too much of the New Testament. We have so much of it that we can spot additions, errors, and corrections by the different geographical regions of the manuscripts. It's actually pretty great. It requires an enormous amount of work, but the work can be done, and it's mostly been done. So here's where Diocletian comes into the picture. Another example, but you get the point already. So, and this is where I tried my hand at animation in the presenter software here. So Diocletian comes along in 300, and he begins to systematically eradicate Christians and churches and so on. And so essentially, here's what happens. What? Did you see? Do you like that? Did you see it? Did you see it? Here, let's do it again. All right. So obviously, Rome is the seat of the emperor. So the church in Rome was almost nearly completely eradicated. Also in Alexandria, Egypt, and so on. It was just the handful of churches in Asia Minor that escaped, essentially. And there was the emperor right after Diocletian who declared Christianity not just illegal, but the preferred religion of the Roman Empire, and that guy's name was Constantine. And so here's basically the story then. What you have is these are the geographical family group of manuscripts that survive the Diocletian persecution. So just so you know, I'm not making this up. This is kind of the standard textbook on the history of the New Testament. Kurt and Barbara Olland, it's a husband and wife, like manuscript team. They're both total introverts. Find pictures of them online. It's really great. So, the persecution of Christians by Diocletian was characterized by the systematic destruction of church buildings. Any manuscripts that were found in them were publicly burned. Church leaders were required to surrender for burning all holy books in their possession. The result was a widespread scarcity of New Testament manuscripts, which became acute when the persecution ceased, right? So Constantine then like changes the whole playing field. And what you then have is, again, Christians all over the ancient world who are clamoring for the precious scriptures to read and read together in their gatherings and so on. And so where are they going to get manuscripts from? Well, the handful of churches that survived, which were mostly in Asia Minor. When Christians could again engage freely in missionary activity, there was a tremendous growth in the size and number of new churches. So there followed a sudden demand for large numbers of New Testament manuscripts in all of the provinces. This growing need could only be met by large copying houses. So any text used as the exemplar, and that's the technical term for the original from which all the copies are made, right? The exemplar. Any text used as the exemplar in such a copying center would naturally be widely distributed and have great influence. Do you understand what they're saying? So all of a sudden, the one copy that becomes the version from which all of these new version copies are made and sent out, like that becomes the most dominant influential text form of the particular book of Matthew or Romans or something like that. So here's, can you see where the story's going then? So here's essentially what happened, is that these texts from Asia Minor become the most common form of the text of the New Testament. It gets copied and recopied and recopied. And this is often called the majority text, or the received text, or the Byzantine text, and so on. And just in terms of sheer number of manuscripts, the number of New Testament manuscripts from all periods of time, all parts of the world, it's just absolutely staggering. It's unparalleled of any text in the history of the world. It's just tens and tens of thousands of manuscripts. The vast majority are these, and which, by the course of history, makes perfect sense, because this was the version of texts that was being preserved. So here's where the story gets really interesting. So in the early 1500s, a guy named Erasmus, you heard of him? So he was a Catholic scholar. This is right before the Reformation burst onto the scene. And he was the first Christian scholar who attempted to get as many manuscripts as he could possibly get his hand on and create a scholarly edition of the New Testament. But even though he traveled around the ancient world at that time, went to as many churches and schools as he possibly could, what kinds of manuscripts is he picking up? The ones that are available, namely the ones that were copied and spread all over the ancient world, you know what I mean, like over 1,000 years ago. It's one particular form of the text. And so that goes into the making of his edition of the New Testament. It was the first scholarly edition. And that version of the New Testament became what's called the majority text. Now, here's what's great. It's a copy. So what he did was, this is a copy from Erasmus's edition. So this is the Gospel according to Matthew, and this is the Greek version here, and then it's a Latin translation of it up here, and then naked babies with wings and so on and other weird things, right? So so this is Erasmus, hugely influential. So influential that just about 15 years later, there's a guy named William Tyndale. You've heard of William Tyndale. So the reason you have an English Bible in your laps is because of William Tyndale. So he was one of the first, and this is by now, the Reformation was really beginning to heat up in terms of debates and so on between Luther and all that kind of, that's a whole other story. But Tyndale was the first scholar to translate the Bible into English. And he actually received a death sentence on his head by the Catholic Church for doing so. But that's a whole other story. So, and for the New Testament, where is he going to go? What Greek version is he going to use as a base to translate into English? Well, of course, Erasmus's text, because that's the most scholarly edition available in his time period. And so this is what's great. These are medieval copies of Tyndale's English translation. So this is from the beginning of John. This is Old English. Can you guys read it up here? Isn't this great? The Gospel of Sankt John. Right? The first, see, this is the S right here. The first chapter. In the beginning. So this is 1500s style English. Isn't this great? In the beginning was the word, and see, word, oh, I guess I blew it up here so we can read it. So the word, and that word was with God, and God was that word. The same was in the beginning with God. All things, look, things spelled with a Y, isn't that interesting? Were made by it, and without it was made new, new thing. Nuthiga, Nuthiga, that made was. In it was life and life. Anyway, isn't that great? That's great. So anyway, so that's Tyndale. Thank you, Tyndale. You know, he put his life on the line so that, because one of the main convictions of the Reformation was the scripture shouldn't be in the possession merely of experts. It should be translated into the language of the people and widely spread so anybody can read them. Okay, so give it another 80 years or so. Tyndale's translation begins to become dated because language changes over time, yeah? And so 80 years. And so there's an innovative new team of scholars who want to create an updated version of the English translation of the Bible. It's very controversial. It's very controversial. What are these innovators doing? Changing the Bible, and so on. And so these innovators produce what, by financial sponsorship of King James, this what's known as the King James Version. Yeah, but so that's based off of what Greek manuscripts? Erasmus's edition, again with the kind of the aid of Tyndale's. And so here you go. There you go. This is kind of the text history of the King James Version. One of the most beautiful English, I mean, just works as a work of English itself. It's just, it's amazingly, amazingly beautiful. And so the King James Version, I mean, was the Bible in English for centuries after that. I mean, just until, like, you know, the last the last, like, 75 years or so. It was the King James. That's the Bible in English. And this is a picture of one of, like, a classic King James translation. Still, look at these interesting S's. Look, this is the letter to the Hebrews connected to the apostle. Isn't that interesting? It doesn't say that anywhere in Hebrews, but so anyhow. All right, so fast forward this to about 150 years, and all of a sudden after, well, there's a whole bunch of stuff about Middle East history, but the Middle East becomes opened up because the British essentially begin to exercise more and more influence in the Middle East. And so you get loads of Europeans who are now for the first time able to go do, like, dig up, like, the pyramids and everything, dig up Jerusalem and do archaeology. This is the classic era of archaeology is in the mid-1800s. And so you get German and British scholars from all over the world converging on Jerusalem and Egypt. And so lo and behold, as this whole movement of archaeology is going, they're discovering biblical manuscripts, but, like, here and here that have been buried in the sand for like 1,500 years, right? So that's really exciting. There's a whole new wave of discovery of the text of the New Testament. And I just want you to see some of the quotes of some of these guys. They were intense introverts, for sure, but really godly introverts, right? So this guy, how's this for a name? Friedrich Constantin von Tischendorf. This is the guy who walked into that monastery in Sinai, Egypt, and found them tearing out sheets of manuscripts to use to paste holes in the wall. So he's the one who found it. Don't name your kid that. So he says, I have become impassioned to seek and utilize the most ancient witnesses to reconstruct the purest form of the Greek scriptures. I have dedicated to myself to this sacred task, the struggle to retain the original form of the New Testament. Or a French scholar, this is really, really beautiful. He says, I've devoted myself to a lifetime of meticulous labors upon the text of the New Testament as an act of worship, undertaken in the full belief that it will be for the service of God and his church. These guys, they aren't like quack archaeologists, Indiana Jones, looking to launch a new conspiracy theory. You know what I mean? Like they really, new manuscripts were being discovered and they wanted to do the hard work that it took to get us back. Look at that more animation, isn't that high tech right there? So essentially here's what happened, is that in this whole wave of new manuscript discoveries, they're digging up all of these manuscripts of the New Testament that predate the persecution of Diocletian, that predate the emergence of these text families as the dominant ones. These are all like super, super old manuscripts. And so this is really exciting. This is awesome. This is the best thing you could possibly imagine. The problem is that some of these manuscripts were different from what popular version of the Bible that's out there? The King James. The King James. And these wars still go on today. Because why would God allow the church to have a version of the Bible that wasn't perfect for a big chunk of its history? So goes the argument. And you got to wrestle. You got to wrestle with that. Because here's a classic example. So here's the Lord's Prayer in the King James. And here is our Father in heaven. Come on, let's say it together. It's the Lord's Prayer. Have you said it yet today? You know, so you'll say it right here. Here we go. King James Version. Let's read it together. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. So that's the classic King James. That's what Erasmus's Greek text read and so on. So all of a sudden, all these versions of Matthew begin to turn up in Egypt, and they just read that. They just read that. So what's missing? Yeah, right. So this little part right here. Thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory. So let's just stop. This is very similar to Jeremiah chapter 10. What's this doing here? What does this sound like to you? It sounds like a little worship. It sounds like what you would say at the ending of a prayer in a worship gathering, doesn't it? So we know from a number of other kind of early, right after the New Testament, early church sources, that the Lord's Prayer was said 3 times a day, very widely in ancient Christianity. It was recited at every gathering of house churches and so on. It was like it was the lifeblood of the worship of early Christian communities. And you can see very clearly that lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Yeah, it's kind of, it's not the most satisfying ending. And so you can see why in a worship gathering, let's round this thing out, And so, and this in a way that's honoring to God. Yours is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. And so you get generations of scribes who have grown up saying this in church, and so did their grandma. And so he becomes a scribe, he's copying, he's passing on, and of course, that's what's going to come out as he's making his version of Matthew and so on. So again, this isn't like tampering. This is the sign of how influential the scriptures were in the life of the church. So much so that that you almost get a symbiotic relationship here. Sometimes too symbiotic, right? So you get a guy like trying to clarify the Trinity in 1 John. It's like, no, stop that, But this one is kind of beautiful because really it's just an expression of worship. Did Jesus say this bit? No, almost certainly not. But what it is it's a sign of how this prayer became woven into the life of worship life of the early church. And that left its mark in the manuscript history of the Gospel of Matthew. So should it be in the Gospel of Matthew? Okay. So I don't think so. It's because it's not original. And what we're looking for in the Gospels is like what Jesus said and what he did. But it is part of the history of the Bible in the life of the church. And for that, I think it's, so I don't have any problem saying it when I say the Lord's Prayer. I just have a little mental note that says Jesus didn't say this, but that's okay. that's okay because I like saying it because it's really beautiful, so that's all right. So just some pictures of some of these early Egyptian papyri. This is actually, there's a new one up for discussion that perhaps predates this, but until recently, this is the oldest piece of the New Testament that existed. It's a little piece of John chapter 18 that's within lifetime of the original Gospel of John. So rad. And most of these Egyptian papyri, they're papyrus, which is going to survive down in the sands of Egypt. But if you have grass paper up in like Gaul, France, where it rains 360 days of the year, Then if you bury something in the ground, is it going to be there in 2 years? No. But if you bury something in the sands of Egypt where it never rains, is it going to be there in 1,000 years? Yeah. So that's why all of this stuff was found in Egypt. So, here you can see this is the ending of Paul's letter to the Philippians, and then you can see here the heading of Paul's letter to the Colossians. This is a great one. And you can see as a phrase here the different grass reed strands right here in the papyrus. It's great. So between all of these manuscripts the New Testament and so on from these early manuscripts, we have the complete thing. It's not like we're missing any part of the New Testament. It's this, we have too much of the New Testament. We got to shave it down, and we can totally shave it down by doing the hard work of comparing. The differences. And so essentially what's happened is that in the 60s, the husband of the husband and wife couple and a guy named Erwin Nessel They got together and began a large-scale scholarly project to make a version of the Greek text that incorporates all of the manuscripts. And so that is the modern edition of the New Testament that's used as the basis for all of the English translations that are in your laps. And so essentially what they've done is it's the text again, and then there's all these, see these little yellow squiggles here? Those are little footnotes marking you down here. And then this is listings of different variant readings in the manuscript. So like in 1 Peter 5, was the guy's name Silas or Silvanus? Well, there's actually two bodies of manuscripts. Some say Silas, some say Silvanus. And you can go look and compare them. And then you have to make a judgment call based off of those two. So there are lots of little teeny tiny differences. Most of them are so minor. It's like, does this word have the word the in front of it or not? You know, the ordering of the words and so on. There's sometimes some that are more significant, like we saw here. But, 95% of the time, you can weigh the evidence and make a probable conclusion. And there you go. Oh, that's done now. So there you go. That's the way the story of the... How are you guys doing? Isn't that interesting? So let me just pause and just say, so I know there are some, the King James kind of Bible wars still go on. So you can obviously see where I land on that issue. I don't know if I'm messing with you with this whole thing about the text of the Bible being changed, but that we can recover the original. But you got to wrestle with that. And actually, I've come to see it really as a beautiful part of how God's word has woven itself into the life of his people, even though Jesus didn't say the kingdom and the power and the glory, whatever. You know, I still want to say it. It's beautiful. But I just know that Jesus didn't say it. So there you go. There you go. I think we'll pause. Hey, take a pause break. Yeah, let's take another stand-up break and about 10 minutes or so, and then we'll dive into the last session. Fire hose off.